had a lot of space. So I was told the problem and then given the space to figure out how to solve it. That makes me tick. And I work very hard to do that for the people who work around me and for me.
Welcome to the Women on the Move podcast from JPMorgan Chase. I'm Sam Saperstein. Women on the Move is a global initiative designed to empower female employees, clients, and consumers to build their careers, grow their businesses, and improve their financial health. Each episode will feature successful and inspiring women who are breaking the mold. They're sharing their career journeys and leadership lessons, talking about their professional and personal goals, and making a difference in the lives of others. This season, I'm taking you to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, where I caught up with many of the women who inspire me every day. Today, I'm speaking with a woman who's leading the digital transformation of one of the most iconic news companies. Meredith Coppett Levien is Chief Operating Officer and Executive Vice President of the New York Times Company. Meredith originally joined the Times in 2013 and was Chief Revenue Officer before being named COO. Under her leadership, The Times has expanded its global reach to over 5 million subscribers, reaching a new audience through its interactive reporting and digital strategy. Meredith and I discuss new trends in journalism, diversity in the newsroom, and the importance of building strong relationships inside and outside of work. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Meredith, it's so great to have you here on our Women on the Move podcast.
I'm so happy to be here, and I'm so proud of you that you're doing this.
Oh, thank you.
And I hear lots of my friends have been on the show.
Well, we have had some all-stars, and it is so great to now have you on here. So let's talk about your job at the New York Times, COO of the New York Times Company. Tell us what that means. What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Oh, that's a good question. I think the easiest way I would describe the work that the teams that I work with and I do is everything we can to make millions more people spend much more time with quality, original, independent journalism. And that means making sure that our digital experiences are as addictive as the journalism itself, and that they help you get to understanding, help you follow something you're interested in, help you follow something you didn't know you were interested in. So we spend a lot of time on that, and it's really good work. It's like the great privilege of my professional life that I get to work at the New York Times, and that I get to do that work at the New York Times, and I know the people who work around me feel the same way.
Well, it is such a long-standing institution and so important in the world of news. I've been reading the Times since I was 16 years old, so I mean, a friend of mine almost for so long. To take it into a new era, though, which you have done, is so important for this institution. What was that like when you had to really push things into the digital world?
It's hard for me to talk about what I've done there without talking about what happened before I came, because that played such a huge role in what I was able to do. I think the thing that's made the biggest difference in the Times' ability to kind of get over the hump of digital transformation, and I think we've just kind of gotten over the hump. It's still hard, still lots of problems to solve, but I think we're over the hump. That the single biggest reason we were able to do that was that there was always investment in the journalism.
So you've been online for a long time, have a great digital app. When I noticed there was a real difference in an experience, and I think we talked about this, was when I read the story after the burning of Notre Dame in Paris. Yeah. And it wasn't only a story that told you what happened, but through pictures and through layers where you got to see every layer of the church burning, and then the text would come up over it. Was so different and so interesting, and I really got to understand the story in a much more nuanced way than I ever had. That was new to me. That was a completely different experience.
Yeah.
So talk about how you're building those things with all those layers.
I would say one of the things that our newsroom excels at particularly is visual and interactive journalism. So journalism where we can actually get you almost to presence, mm-hmm. where you feel like you can, in the case of Notre Dame, it was like you had a 360 view of how it had been constructed, what the different layers were when they were built, and so you could understand the devastation of this fire and how close the world came to losing Notre Dame entirely. There's a very large team in the newsroom, the New York Times, that does visual and interactive journalism. I think they're the best in the world at what they do. And it's a very big area of continued investment and focus for the Times. If you look at some of the biggest topics that we're covering now, like climate, you know, we're here in Davos, there's a lot of discussion about the environment and environmental sustainability. One of the ways that the Times is covering the environment differently is we're bringing it to life through visual journalism and interactive journalism. We did this incredible feature, I want to say a year and a half ago, about melting glaciers and the implications of that. And it was all done in this unbelievable visual way. And I think it's all made through drone photography. And you were just able to see the melting glaciers in a way you couldn't. So it brings you understanding.
Right. And, with new technology.
Yeah.
Couldn't have done before. So what does that mean in terms of the skill set you now need at the Times to do all of this work? How has that changed in the recent past?
Yeah. One of the biggest areas of investment in the last few years has been for journalists who work in audio, audio producers. You know, The Daily didn't exist 3 years ago, and today it's been downloaded a billion times and is listened to by 2 million people every day, most of whom never read a newspaper as a habit, most of whom are under 40.
So they were not reading The Times in the past.
The Daily is reaching a much younger audience than The New York Times traditionally reached, certainly when it was largely a paper, but even younger than our digital audience. And we've got a team of close to 50 people now who make The Daily and make our other audio journalism. And you know, that was not a discipline that we were working in. It's really interesting, actually, in audio in particular. It's a relatively new discipline in journalism broadly, mm-hmm. not just at The New York Times. So there's a lot of taking people who've done another kind of journalism and teaching them how to do audio journalism.
That's really interesting.
That's been fun. But that's the case in visual and interactive, which I just talked about. It's certainly the case in video. You know, we have some video journalism is a much bigger part of the report today, and I would say in the last couple of years, than it's been. We couldn't have the report that we have now without being able to show a lot of what's going on in the world. So it's just much more varied skill set. I would say equally interesting on the business side, the center of the business organization at the New York Times now is a digital product organization. Mm. So we hired more than 100 net new engineers last year. We'll do the same thing again this year. We're hiring many people in product management and digital design, data science, data analytics. 5 years ago, you know, we had nowhere near that number of people. And that's the central business engine.
So with all these investments, you're really driving so many more subscribers, and particularly paid subscribers.
Yeah, in January, made three big announcements at the Times. We are essentially running a strategy that began in 2015, which was centered on being a subscription business first. And we said then that we intended to double our digital revenue in a five-year time horizon. And we actually ended up doing that in 4 years.
Congratulations.
So we just crossed that milestone. We also, in 2019, crossed the 5 million, just crossed the 5 million subscriptions milestone, and a huge part of that was we did just over 1 million net new subscription additions in 2019. So the growth is accelerating, which is a good sign for the model. We've said publicly we want to be at 10 million, so we're halfway there. I would say, you know, we see that more as like a milestone, mm-hmm. not an end state. Mm-hmm.
Yep. No, you're setting the goals then ever farther. This is great.
When I got to the company a decade ago, so a little before I got to the company, 2/3 of the company's revenue was advertising. 1/3 of it was from subscriptions and other businesses. Today, 2/3 of the company's revenue is coming from subscriptions.
That is a big change.
Well over $1 billion in subscription revenue at the Times.
Wow. Now, through that, those new subscribers, are you reaching different segments of people? Are you reaching people in different geographies, ages, socioeconomic groups?
Yeah.
How's that changed?
I mean, with a much larger subscriber base. Obviously, we have a much more varied audience. I'll go back to my point about the Daily. If you look at all the places people come to the Times on a daily basis, so a couple million of them read the Daily every day. We have millions of people who get our morning briefing newsletter every day. We have millions of people who go to our app every day. That audience over the last 5 years has gotten much larger, it's gotten more female, it's gotten younger, and it's gotten more varied in terms of where people come from, both in the United States and around the world. The audience for the New York Times now is more than a third from outside the United States. We're actually growing subscriptions, digital subscriptions, faster outside the United States.
Wow, that's so interesting.
So, you know, our intention is to be one of the big global news providers of independent original journalism. And so we see our audience as a global one.
So let's talk about reaching women. You're reaching more women, as you said.
Yeah.
What do you think the coverage itself, and perhaps more of a focus on gender issues, has done to help you reach more women?
Yeah, there are a number of things to say about that. One is there has absolutely been a focus in the newsroom in building a more diverse team. We hired, I don't have the number for 2019, I know in 2018, we hired something on the order of 100, 110 net new journalists. So the newsroom keeps getting bigger. And of those, 70% of them were women and people of color. Many of them were young people, millennials, or Gen Z. So we are hard at work broadening the population of the New York Times newsroom. And we're doing that as we get bigger. And it's certainly a big area of focus. And I would say having a more diverse newsroom improves equality in the report. You know, one of the most vivid examples of that is, I don't think the two Times stories that played a very big role in ushering in the Me Too movement would have happened without the women behind those stories. So Emily Steele, and she had a male partner, Mike Schmidt, on the Bill O'Reilly story. I don't think we got to the main or the first source in that Bill O'Reilly story without Emily Steele building a relationship with her. And I don't think we would have gotten to Ashley Judd and the women who went on the record with Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey about Harvey Weinstein had those women not been pursuing them and building relationships. So
yes.
I think diversity in the work of journalism has a big impact in equality in the presentation of journalism.
So as you and your teams think about steering the Times toward a more digital world, how do you think about change management and really taking a very old established institution into a new direction?
Yeah. Well, before I tell you what I think the business side team has done, let me just say broadly the sort of layup we had coming into the work we're doing now for all of the era of digital. In good times and in bad times, the one thing that's been consistent at the New York Times is that the first available dollar for anything goes to the journalism. And I would say that has made the biggest difference in the Times being able to get over the chasm of changing the business model, of becoming a digital-first business.
And do you think that's because people, your staff, continues to see the investments and the importance you put in journalism first and foremost?
I think it's because we make a product that's worth paying for and that is worth paying for even in the presence of free alternatives. And we make a product that has real meaning and value in people's lives. And I think that is the case for any company in transformation. First, you have to know what you're trying to do, what your mission is, and then you have to do that really, really well. And I think it's been very well understood at the Times that we're in the business of seeking truth and giving people the opportunity for understanding. And the key in our business for doing that is to invest in the journalism. So in terms of digital transformation and change, I would say there were two really big pivots that have already happened in the business and one that we're in the middle of. The first one was obviously print to digital. By the time I showed up on the scene, I remember asking Mark Thompson, the CEO and my boss who hired me, I don't want to come to try and save the newspaper ad business because I think that's only going in one direction. And, you know, he said, we're in the business of trying to find a sustainable model for journalism, not newspapers. And that's been true the whole way through. So there was never any kind of protection of the paper as a thing. It was always protection of the sustainability of the journalism. So we've been able to make the print to digital transition. And by the way, our print product is still beloved by consumers,
I'm sure,
and a very profitable and healthy product, but we understand what its ultimate trajectory will be. The second big transition, and this one was culturally hard and, you know, profoundly important to the getting to the times where it is today. 10 years ago, we were a business that brought in 2/3 of its revenue from advertising. Today, we are a business that brings in 2/3 of its revenue from subscriptions. So calling, we are a subscription business first. We are in the business first of doing something for consumers. Really, really important to being able to accelerate digital growth for the company. And by the way, in the end, good for the ad business as well.
Right.
And then the third big change, the one we're right in the middle of, is making the digital product of the New York Times an even better engine of the business, of what makes people form a habit with the New York Times and ultimately buy a subscription and stay. What that has been, we had spent years getting really good at marketing, at becoming a brand, at selling subscriptions. But the truth is, we've got 150 million people who come to the Times every month, tens of millions every week. They're coming to us from Google or from Facebook or some kind of private message or from some other source. How do we actually use the fact that they've landed on our product to turn them into someone who has a habit with the Times, who's next time going to come directly to the Times? And we are right in the middle of that big change and transformation. And I would say that will define the next inflection point for
right.
the Times.
And are you looking at that as a new customer experience, a new way people would interact and find things?
It's partly that. We think that news is kind of best experienced when someone has a relationship with the provider of that news. So there's a lot of effort at the Times now to drive direct relationships through our experience, get people to download our app, get them to give us their email address, get them to register and log in when they're with us so that we can make the experience more relevant for them. So there's that piece of it. There's the business piece of it, which is most of the experience people have with the New York Times now is a digital experience. You know, there's like 1 million, 2 million people who experience the paper every week. There's 50 times that who experience us digitally every week. So we are competing with the best digital products out there in terms of the way we deliver that experience. So from a business perspective, the big change is we've got to get as good at making the software through which people find and experience journalism as the big tech companies are. And that's hard work.
But it's amazing to think about it as becoming a technology company, in essence, not only a journalism
yeah,
and content company.
I would say we're a journalism company who has to be great at technology to keep scaling our business. And technology is at the center of the business growth of the New York Times.
So tell us about your career journey before you got to the New York Times. So speaking of advertising, way back in the day, you did work in that squarely.
Yes.
And would just, you know, love to hear about your journey.
Yeah. I have not worked at a lot of places, and I've spent most, now I think I can say the majority of my working years in the publishing business. And I've worked for what I would say were great brands in publishing and just great people. I spent a decade of my career working in two different businesses for a man named David Bradley, who is the co-owner now of The Atlantic, was the sole owner when I worked for him. Much of what I learned about how to be effective in business came from working for David Bradley, seeing how David Bradley worked. So that just shaped my career profoundly.
He has a way of spotting talent.
I would say, like, the big lesson of my career is there is nothing more important than the talent. When you're coming up in your career, there's nothing more important than who you're working with alongside who you work for. And when you're in a position to hire and see that teams are well led, there's nothing more important than that. And I learned that spending the first 10 years of my career working largely for him. I had 5.5 years at Forbes, great experience there, worked for a great boss there. And I have had an incredible boss and mentor and sponsor in Mark Thompson at the Times. And so I would just say, I've had the privilege of getting to work on great brands. I also worked on in a space I was really passionate about. I've just been a lifelong lover of independent journalism. So getting to like do work on the business side of something I loved was really important to me. And then I would say, in terms of the people that I worked for, I think the thing that I was most lucky about is I was given big, meaty problems to solve. And you know what? I wasn't always great at solving them, but I was given long enough to sort of figure it out or find the right people around me so that a group of us could figure it out.
So with that in mind, you had people behind you who were helping to steer you, or if you made mistakes, they were behind you and supporting you. How do you translate those learnings into the people that you now manage and support and bring up?
I didn't mention a really important mentor I had for much of the time that I worked for David Bradley. I worked for a woman named Elizabeth Keffer, and the whole time I worked for Elizabeth, I worked directly for her for most of those years, I always felt like I was important to her. I always felt like my development, my success, how I got better and better, and particularly things I wasn't good at, it really mattered to her, and I took a lot from that. I don't know if I always do it well, but I have certainly tried to carry that into the people around me. The other thing I would say is I just, for whatever reason, I felt like I, certainly in the last, you know, 6, 7, 8, maybe even 10 years, I've had a lot of space. So I was told the problem and then given the space to figure out how to solve it. And I really appreciated that. That makes me tick. And I work very hard to do that for the people who work around me and for me. I don't know if I always get it right, but I'm very conscious of, am I sending the problem over in a clear way? And am I actually giving this leader the full chance to solve it, or this group of people the full chance to solve it? So I would say I've been well led that way, and I work hard to try and lead.
That's
well
fantastic that's a conscious effort on your behalf to do that. You know, I think some people have habits that are hard to break. They might be a micromanager, for example, the opposite of what you're talking about. But the fact that you've observed and really were able to flourish under a different system and brought that to your own folks, I think is really remarkable.
I can say without a doubt, when I came up through a particular business, it was much harder not to micromanage. You know, when you know where all the levers are in that business, it's very hard when you're leading it to not say, well, I know how to do that. Let me tell you how to do it. So that is a conscious effort. The more my job became moving across to other businesses and saying, can we get the right structure in place? Can we match strategy, structure, operating model, and people? When that became my job, it's much easier to give people the space, because the reality is I don't know how to solve the problems.
Yeah, who had the answers?
They do.
Right, right. But you trusted them to do that with you, which is great. I think I will disclose here that you and I also have a personal relationship.
We're friends in real life. We're school mom friends.
We're school mom friends. Our kids went to school for 1 year together. That really was it. But I remember the first time meeting you, we were both at Chelsea Piers in Manhattan.
Yep, watching our kids play basketball.
Probably badly, because they were 3 years old at the time. And I remember looking over.
My son would be upset if I didn't say he's really good now.
I'm sure he's so much better now. But they couldn't even reach the net back then.
That's right. That's right.
And it was funny when we discovered that our kids were actually in the same class, and then it almost became a standing date.
We did. We had a Sunday morning date. Yeah.
Where we were able to at least enjoy that time. But having seen you in action now in different settings, I see how you really develop these friendships with other professional women that are very important to you, as, you know, not only people to enjoy time with, but people who will support you. And you know they have your back. I hope you do. But talk about that. What is the role of these other professional women friends in your life?
I've been working 2.5 decades now. That's still a struggle. And I would say one of the things that I am most focused on is trying to be a loving and effective and listening parent, and also an effective leader of leaders. And I don't always get that right. And I would just say that takes up a lot of my mental energy, trying to do both of those things. And that brings me to the answer to the other question, which is, I don't know that I would even have the language to talk about that or be comfortable talking about it if I didn't have a community of other women who were doing the same thing. We might be officially the second generation of women who are able to go out and have very full careers and also fight to be good spouses and parents. And so I have found it incredibly helpful to have a community of women who I can say, how do you do this? In practical terms, how do you do it? In sort of emotional terms, how do you do it? It's been really effective. I also want to say, particularly in the last few years, there have just been some women who I have watched really push for more equality in places where there isn't enough of it. And I admire those women so much, and I want to make sure I'm doing my part. One of them is Shelley Zales.
Yes.
We are recording this in her lounge at Davos, where there still aren't enough women. There certainly weren't enough women the first year I came. I could come to the Equality Lounge that first year when there wasn't enough on my calendar to feel like I had a great purpose being here. And women like Shelley have just made the forums for women to support other women. And I would say increasingly, I've just learned how to do my job better from exchanging with women like that. We hosted a dinner last night with about 40 women. You were there.
Yes.
We had the CEO of Williams-Sonoma, and we had Pat Russo, the chair of the HPE board, and so many other incredible women. And it was actually a group of women talking about business problems and talking about how leadership has to change because the conditions in which we work change. And so that's just been a huge part of what's made me enjoy my work in the last decade, and also what's made me better at it.
It was so special last night, I think, to have those conversations around just the business issues everybody faces all the time, but to hear probably different perspectives than we might not always hear, and then get to know people personally, which is always a really nice thing to do.
It was great, and it's worth saying, we could do that in rooms with men, too. We
yes,
both of us
of
do that in plenty of great forums in our jobs. The point of gathering the women here is there really still aren't enough women. As all the groups of women and people of color here focus together on how do we make WEF a more diverse place, how do we make business a more diverse place, I think that has real impact.
Yeah, and the relationships extend beyond this. So
yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Not just this week, but going back to our workplaces, our different cities, the connections that we can still make. So I think people would really like to know, how does the page one meeting go down at the Times? How do you decide what stories people are going to see first?
So 5 years ago, even 6 years ago when I got to the Times, that really was the meeting where a few dozen people sat around, people with extraordinary judgment and expertise sat around and were able to say, what are the half dozen, eight, nine most important stories of the moment? What is their relative importance? Just that idea of kind of being able to order the world that way, I don't think that has lost its value in journalism. The front page of a newspaper and what it does for each day and time may not have as many users anymore.
Right.
But the idea of what it was meant to do doesn't change. The meeting itself has evolved so that now it's, okay, what are the most important stories? How do they relate to each other? And then how do they express themselves in audio? How do they express themselves on the homepage of our app? How do they express themselves on social media? What is actually worth going to the weekly for our television show? So to me, there is still this really big idea in a twice-day gathering of the top of the newsroom to say, what's the agenda? What's the story agenda? But the way it finds expression is much more varied.
So when I used to read a hard paper, I knew the lead story was the most important all the way on the right, and then I could read one all the way on the left.
Yeah.
When you're in a digital app, how do you know?
Question. So I think that is one of the profound questions of journalism today. That is a huge problem that I expect many in journalism are trying to solve, and we are working actively on. It's not been replicated anywhere in the desktop or in digital or certainly on a mobile device.
Right.
How do you do relative importance?
Yeah.
And that the idea of a phone screen, you know, you're very constrained by space. So, you know, at best, you can show a few things at once. And oh, by the way, you can update that all day long. So what you're seeing now, if you're a regular user of the New York Times, is we are experimenting much more aggressively with how often that home screen changes.
Are
experimenting very aggressively this week with the impeachment hearings happening, with live journalism. So how do we bring you into a story as it's happening now? And you will see us over the next few years continue to get better and better and more deliberate at how we program our mobile surface in the way that there's been a century and a half of being deliberate about how we program that newspaper service.
Well, for right now, my strategy is just I read most popular, but then I go back to today's paper and I make sure I haven't missed something that might not have been popular, but it's still interesting for me to read.
Yeah, and look, I think we're in a moment where habits are still being formed, and I think we've got a lot of opportunity to create a set of design cues and a set of UX patterns on a phone that get at how does one story relate to another? How does a group of stories relate? How do we signal what is news versus what is opinion? What should be presented visually on the surface of the app versus you actually click into something and see it? Those are all questions we're actively working on.
Well, I look forward to seeing how you're going to solve them, and I know you will. So thank you, Meredith. It is always a pleasure to see you.
So nice to be here. Thanks so much.
Thanks to Meredith Coppett-Levien for joining me at Davos to discuss her work at the New York Times. Thank you for joining us today. The mission of Women on the Move is to help women in their professional and personal lives. Our goal is to introduce you to people with great ideas, inspiring stories, and a passion to make a difference. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe so you won't miss any others. Thank you to our partners at the Female Quotient and Magnet Media for helping us tell these stories. For JPMorgan Chase's Women on the Move, I'm Sam Saperstein.